This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
Let's first lay down some ground rules for what we're going to do tonight and what we're not going to do tonight. What we're not going to do tonight, and I think this is as opposed to what may have taken place over the last several weeks, is we are not going to evaluate the claims of Judaism versus the claims of Christianity or any other religion. What we're going to try to do tonight is to lay down, to present what the traditional, historic Jewish belief has been regarding the Mashiach, the Messiah, and the eschatology of the final days. So this is a presentation simply what Judaism traditionally, what historical Judaism has believed, presented, and then at least we know what we're talking about and what we are going to be trying to compare and evaluate vis-a-vis the claims of other religions. Now, the two scholars who are most noteworthy in our discussion tonight are two medieval scholars that lived in the 1100s, Maimonides, better known as the Rambam, and his contemporary Nachmanides, better known as the Ramban. They were actually not colleagues. They lived at opposite ends of the known world. The Rambam lived in his early life in Spain, but later in Egypt, and Nachmanides, the Ramban, actually lived in Spain. But they did engage in joint scholarship efforts. In fact, the Ramban wrote critiques and comments on many of the books of the Rambam, and there's quite a bit of give and take between the two, differences of opinion, areas of agreement, and they are two of the premier medieval scholars who derive their positions from the Talmud, which of course is the basic work of Rabbinic Judaism, and thus is the source for almost everything that has followed over the last 1,000 years. The discussion of the Messiah and the end of days and the resurrection of the dead really comes to the forefront in the discussion of reward and punishment. One of the tenets of Judaism is that there is reward and punishment. No good deed goes unpunished, and no misdeed goes unrewarded. That was a joke, if you caught it. Now, reward and punishment. The question is, what is the reward that God has in store for man if he lives the good life? So there was a lot of confusion on this point. There were those that believed that the ultimate reward is the good of this world, the pleasures of this world, wealth, good health, good friends, comfort. And the truth is, if you go to the Torah, the Bible, you find a lot of support for that position. The Torah often says, if you do my mitzvahs, the rain will fall in the proper time, and your flocks will be fruitful, and your calves will not miscarry, and there will be peace in the land. So there's a lot of basis for that idea that the ultimate reward for living a good life is to enjoy the benefits of this world. Some of the problems with that position are that based on empirical evidence, we see that it's not so. It seems that the righteous, in fact, do suffer, and the wicked do prosper. Now, as it has been pointed out, the question that we see the righteous suffering is not as difficult a problem as the opposite, because we don't know the skeletons in everyone's closet. Whereas maybe that person who, on the outside, appears to be very pious is really a crypto-wicked person. So perhaps that question we can push aside. But the problem of the wicked prospering is a very, very serious problem. People that are wicked, we can usually tell that they're wicked. And it's hard to imagine that they're doing so many charitable things in secret that would outweigh their apparent wickedness. So to say that the ultimate reward and punishment is in this worldly things is very difficult. Then there were those that believed that the ultimate reward for good deeds is to participate in the glories of the Messianic age. Another opinion. Now, there's a difficulty with that, because there have been many wonderful people who have lived throughout the last several thousand years who are not going to make it. they obviously have not yet experienced the Messianic age, and they are no longer here to experience it. So to say that that is the ultimate reward which is held out for all righteous people also poses a problem. Then there was a third opinion that said that the reward for the righteous is the world to come. And let's get used to using the Hebrew term for that. Okay, there are two worlds. There is Olam Hazeh. Olam Hazeh means this world. Olam is world, and Hazeh is this. In Hebrew, the adjective follows the noun. That's one of the peculiarities of Hebrew syntax. So Olam Hazeh means this world. And then there is the world to come, which is Olam Haba, which means world to come. Coming world. So there are those that believe that the reward for the righteous is to experience the bliss of the world to come. But what is the world to come? What's going to happen in the world to come? So there are those that imagine that the world to come is just an opportunity to have amplified physical pleasures. Whereas in this world, a bottle of wine might be pleasurable. In the world to come, there'll be rivers flowing with wine. And whatever you're into will grow on trees. I don't know whether you're into chocolate. Chocolate will grow on trees. Whatever it is will grow on trees. Some of the pleasures obviously aren't mentionable in proper company, but that also will grow on trees. So now, that was another theory. The Rambam says that all of these three theories, that the reward for the righteous are pleasures of this world, that it is to witness the Messianic age, that it is some supernatural next world wherein physical pleasures are enjoyed, are all mistaken. That is not the reward for the righteous. The reward for the righteous is Olam Haba. It is the world to come. But a totally different what the world to come is. What the world to come is in Judaism is a spiritual world. A spiritual world. The pleasures of the world to come are spiritual pleasures. The Talmud says that the world to come does not have eating, it does not have drinking, none of the things associated with this world. There's no sex in the world to come, nothing. No physical pleasures at all. The world to come is tzaddikim, the pious, sitting with their crowns on their heads, deriving pleasure from the radiance, from the splendor of the Shechina, which is the divine presence. Basking in the light, in the presence of God, that is the pleasure of the world to come. So to me, doesn't sound too exciting. I mean, that's it, and that's what we're all working for, the world to come. So the Rambam tells us that the reason we don't understand that is because in the same way that a person born blind could not understand, possibly in a million years, the concept of color, or a person born deaf could not understand in a million years the concept of music or tonality. So says the Rambam, we who exist, our souls imprisoned in human bodies, cannot imagine the concept of a purely spiritual pleasure. We can't fathom it. We can't understand it. We shouldn't even try to understand it. It's beyond us. But our rabbis tell us that it is the most intensely pleasurable experience that exists. To the extent that, by analogy, they try to tell us, if you would take all the pleasures of this world, all the pleasures of this world, and you could concentrate them into one nanosecond of pleasure. When we talk about pleasures of this world, that means pleasures that I've ever experienced in my entire lifetime. But all the pleasures that anyone who ever will walk the face of this earth has experienced, take all their pleasure, the pleasure of the billions of people that live on planet Earth, concentrate that into one moment of pleasure, one millisecond of pleasure, that pleasure is not equal to a whiff of the pleasure of the world to come. And the world to come, on top of everything else, is eternal as well. Now, you know what eternity is? You know what eternity is? So there's an example given in the classic book. Imagine a mountain. A mountain. Every 1,000 years, a bird comes, descends on this mountain, and removes a grain of sand. Every 1,000 years. 1,000 years later, a bird comes again, takes away a grain of sand. When the entire mountain is gone, eternity will not have yet begun. That's eternity. So the bliss of the world to come is a spiritual bliss, which is beyond our grasp, beyond our conception, but we know that it is more intense and more powerful and more glorious than any pleasure of this world. And on top of everything, it's eternal. That is the reward for the good deeds that we do. So that's the Rambam's position. Now, the Rambam, however, now has to face a dilemma. Because there's something else mentioned in the Talmud called Tchiyas HaMesim, which means the resurrection of the dead. Now, the Talmud seems to posit that the resurrection of the dead, the belief in the resurrection of the dead, is a fundamental belief. To the extent that the Talmud says, if a person denies the resurrection, the punishment is to lose your share in the world to come. Now that's pretty heavy. You're losing quite a bit. You're losing the world to come for denial of the resurrection. So the resurrection must be very important. But why? Why would you want to come back? You see, again, the Rambam tells us that the reward for mitzvos is the world to come. Where is the world to come? When do we go to the world to come? So the Rambam tells us. Perhaps I should have made this more explicit. The world to come is not called the world to come, says the Rambam, because it isn't here yet. Right? It's called the world to come because we're not there yet. I mean, I hope I'm not laboring the obvious. In other words, there are two worlds that exist side by side. We are presently in this world, and when we die, our souls will go on to that world. But that world is there. It exists. There are many people that are presently there, people that have already gone to this world. In the same way that, for example, a baby is conceived in the mother's womb and enters a new world upon birth. So we as well, when we die, there is a rebirth into the world to come. So if you're already in that world, why would you possibly want to come back? Why should there be a resurrection? What is the meaning of a resurrection? Why should a person want to leave the bliss of the world to come, as glorious as it is, and come back to this strangely imperfect, relatively miserable world? So the Rambam tells us that there's a very important function in coming back. You see, many people, most people, sadly, have spent their proverbial 70 years in this world in times that have not provided them with sufficient opportunities or the maximum opportunity to earn their share in the world to come. Because many people are born into this world to experience persecutions, suffering, ignorance. And as a result, they don't have the opportunity to learn Torah. They don't have the opportunity to perform God's mitzvos, the commandments. And as a result, they are handicapped. Even if they may be successful in earning a share in the world to come, but it isn't a magnificent share. You know, just like in this world, there are different neighborhoods. Some better, some more exclusive, fancier. Some have swimming pools in the back. Some are lucky to have a bath and shower. So in the world to come, it's the same thing. Depending on how pious and how righteous a person is, undoubtedly there are better shares than there are worse shares. So there's an inequity. Because some people in this world have the opportunity to earn magnificent shares in the world to come. And many people during their stay in this world did not have such great opportunities to earn shares in the world to come. So how is that inequity going to be solved? So one would be tempted to say that the way that inequity can be avoided is that God should grade in a curve. Because God should say, well, look, we're not going to judge you by an objective scale as to how many mitzvahs you did. We're going to judge you by what is expected of you. Naturally, if you lived in a time when Jews were persecuted, and you lived in a time where Jews were estranged from their heritage, naturally, less is expected of you than if you lived in a time where Jewish heritage was common. So that's one possibility, that God grades in a curve. However, the Rambam, it seems, rejects that answer. Why does he reject that answer? Because I think the Rambam believes that the good deeds we do, and in turn are rewarded, it isn't that, you know, we do a job so God rewards us. But actually, the good deeds that we do, in a sense, nourish our soul, they prepare our soul, and makes our soul receptive for that spiritual pleasure of the world to come. It's in the same way that if you eat a good diet, you'll be healthy. If you feed yourself with junk food, you won't be healthy. And it has nothing to do with how apprised you are of the rules of nutrition. It has nothing to do with whether you're ignorant of good nutrition, whether you're aware of good nutrition. It's just the way it is. If you eat well, you'll be nourished. If you don't eat well, you won't be nourished. So the Rambam argues it's the same thing with mitzvahs. The good deeds that we do are nourishment for our souls. They prepare our souls to be receptive and to enjoy that spiritual bliss of the world to come. So it doesn't make a difference, in a sense, whether you know, whether you don't know. You have to have the opportunity. You have to take advantage of the opportunity. So the Rambam says that the way the inequity is solved is that you're brought back. You're brought back. You are brought back to this world in a better time, in a better place, where now you have those opportunities. Where is that better time? Where is that better place? So there must be that sometime in the course of history, in this world, the world will be brought to a better stage of existence, an improved stage of an existence, a stage of existence where opportunities will exist for spiritual advancement, where the inequities of the past could be solved by bringing everyone back to have equal opportunities to live and die again and ultimately go in the world to come. That, says the Rambam, is the Messianic Age. The Messianic Age is a phenomenon of this world. It's not the next world. The Messianic Age is also part of Olam Hazeh. But what it is a better world. A world in which ignorance has been wiped out. A world in which persecution has been wiped out. A world in which those who live to see it and those who are brought back to it have an opportunity to live productively, learning Torah, serving God, living a good life, until they die again, and ultimately will go again to the next world, which is Olam Haba. So let's see if we have this picture, at least of the Rambam's eschatology. We live now in this world. This world will eventually, somehow, by some process, evolve into a better world, which is called the Messianic Age, which will provide unique opportunities for becoming close to God and earning greater and greater shares in the world to come, which is the world to which we go after we die. And where resurrection fits in, resurrection is an opportunity. People are taken out of that world to come. They're taken out of the bliss of the world to come. And they're put back here for the opportunity to live again in better circumstances to earn even greater and greater shares of the world to come. In the Messianic Age, there'll be no excuse. There'll be no persecutions. There'll be no ignorance. In the Messianic Age, your shortcomings will be your responsibility alone. But the opportunities are so great that those who are deserving, who tried their best the first time around, will be brought back for a second time around to increase and improve their shares in the world to come. So that is the Rambam's, Maimonides' conceptualization of how the various parts work. This world, when we live in, evolves into the Messianic Age. People that are living at that time will experience the Messianic Age and die, go on to the world to come. People that have already gone on to the world to come will be brought back to re-experience this life in the Messianic Age and hopefully go back to the world to come in better position. Yes?
Unless I'm misunderstanding you, based on what you're saying, that means nobody's left on planet Earth.
Pardon?
That means no one's left on Earth.
At what time?
After the last stage.
At the end of the Messianic Age.
At the end.
Exactly. You see, the Rambam doesn't comment on this explicitly, but the Rambam does say
that. I was commenting on the Rambam.
Yeah.
I was commenting on my understanding of what you said.
The Rambam does say as follows. The Rambam says that in the Messianic Age, people will still die. People will still be born. The Messiah himself, the Rambam says, will be the founder of a dynasty, which will continue. And therefore we'll have this ongoing process of people living in this world, living the good life, hopefully, going on to the world to come, there'll be new people replacing them. So there's nothing in that which I said which implies that there's going to be an end to this world. Now, this is problematic, because there are texts in the Talmud which do indicate that the world will come to an end, but the truth is, in the Rambam system of thinking, there is no explicit mention of that. The Messianic Age is not defined by the Rambam as having an end. There is no implication in the Rambam's discussions of the Messianic Age that it will end.
What could its purpose in continuing?
Well, the purpose in continuing is this. It really is the reason that God made this world in the first place. Because God made this world, the next world, to give man an opportunity to earn the ultimate bliss. You see, the fundamental question that all religions have to ask themselves is that why did God make man? Now, God has no needs. At least our conception of God is that God has no needs. And therefore, why should God have wanted to create? So the Kabbalistic interpretation which is given is that whereas God is good, is the ultimate good, it is the nature of that which is good to bestow good. And therefore God had to create man in order to bestow his goodness upon man. Now, God could have made Club Med, brought people into the world, and it just would be vacation. But God also understood that the truth is that something is really not good unless you've earned it. If you earn it, you work for it, then it's really good. And therefore, God in his wisdom decided that we should have two worlds. One world will be the world in which we earn our keep, and the place of enjoyment, of reward, is the world to come. Now, for whatever reason, the world to come does not provide the opportunities that it should have had to earn one's keep. Somehow the plan got ruined. Whether this is a consequence of the story of Adam and Eve, or for other inherent reasons, is beyond the scope of our discussion tonight. But the world is not exactly what it should be. The world will be rectified in the Messianic Age. And therefore in the Messianic Age, it seems from the Rambam's conceptualization, life will continue for the original divine purpose, which is to provide God an opportunity to bestow goodness on man, that man should be brought into this world, live a good life, earn his keep by making the right choices, and in turn to be rewarded in the world to come. Whereas it's not going to end. There's no reason to assume in the Rambam's way of describing things that it should ever end.
Right, but it sounded like TSMASM is a long period of time.
No, Trias Amesim is just an opportunity for those people who spent their 70 years in this world during its imperfect stage to settle that inequity and bring them back in the perfect stage.
Right, but it makes it seem like this period could be 100, 200, 300, 400 years that the resurrection
But when they come back, they'll live to 70 years again.
Well, if that's the case, it makes it seem like if a person is living in this world and resurrections are going on, a person's going to say, well, don't worry, if I live and I'm not doing the right thing, don't worry. If I die, I'll go back up and I'll come back again.
Yeah, well, see, that is a good point, except for one thing. And I'll just comment on this, that it's clear from the Talmud that the only people that are deserving of the resurrection are people that tried their best, in a sense, their first time around. You see, people that did not try their best, they aren't going to come back. People that tried their best but are victims of the fact they lived in times where the opportunities weren't provided them, they will come back. So you can't say, well, I'll live the wild life now and I'll come back resurrected and straighten things out then. Or that doesn't necessarily work out. Okay, this is the position of the Rambam. The Ramban, Nachmanides, takes issue, as one would expect. Two Jews, three opinions. Nachmanides takes issue. And he bases his argument on certain sources in the Talmud, which seem to indicate that the world to come is not a world which exists in the present side by side with this world, but rather the world to come is a new universe which has not yet been created. For example, the Talmud says that this world, the world as we know it, will exist for 6,000 years. 6,000 years. The 7,000th year, the world will not exist. God will alone exist. As it says in the verse, that the Lord alone shall be exalted on that day. And we know that in the metaphor of the Bible, a day is equal to 1,000 years. As it says in the Psalms, that 1,000 years is but a day in God's eye. And after that 7,000th year, the world will be renewed again. And that, says the Ramban, is the reference to Olam Haba. Whenever the Talmud speaks about the world to come, it is speaking about that new universe, which will be created after the demise of the present universe. Now, says the Ramban, that universe, that is the place where the righteous are rewarded. And the resurrection of the righteous that have died will be not back into this world, but into that new world. That is the resurrection. That is the place of resurrection. Resurrection is not a return to this world. Resurrection is a rebirth into that new world. If you've lived a good life in this world, you'll be resurrected into that world with body and soul. Says the Ramban that is a spiritual world. It's a spiritual world. But it is a spiritual world in which bodies and souls will exist together. The Ramban says that although the Talmud says there's no eating and no drinking, that doesn't imply there'll be no bodies. There'll be bodies. But the bodies will be elevated to spiritual stature that they won't require physical sustenance. That is the world to come. So now what happens to a person when he dies? He's no longer in this world. The world to come has not yet been created. So where does he go? So in the meantime, says the Ramban, there is a repository for souls, which he calls the soul world. And that's what happens. The body is buried, the soul goes on to the soul world, wherein it is also rewarded. It's also a spiritually blissful world, but not the ultimate. The ultimate is the resurrection into the world to come. Where does the messianic age fit in the Ramban scheme of things? So the Ramban also says that the messianic age is very much a phenomenon of this world. Of this world. It is the fulfillment of the goals of history, but it will take place in this world. So in terms of the eschatology, the Rambam and the Ramban are in agreement that the messianic age is an experience of this world. The difference of opinion is regarding the world to come. Maimonides says the world to come is the soul world into which all souls go after they die. The resurrection is a return to this world in the Messianic age to have greater opportunities to live and in turn die and go to the world to come. Whereas the Ramban says that no, the world to come is a new world, which has not yet been created, and the resurrection is the rebirth into that new universe of those that have been deserving in this world. So this is just an overview of the two basic schools of thought on the eschatology of this world, the world to come, and the Messianic age, at least as to where each takes place. Any questions on that? No questions? Okay, very good. Let's talk about the Messianic age. Okay, what is the Messianic age? What is supposed to happen in the Messianic age? Will there be miracles? Or will things follow a natural course? Maimonides is of the position that there is no necessity to assume that miracles will take place. Miracles may take place, but it is not a fundamental of faith to believe that miracles will take place. What the Messianic age is the fulfillment of the utopian plan of Torah for this world. You see, Torah is not only a book of laws. It's a plan. It's a blueprint. It's a blueprint for a utopian world. The Messianic age is the fulfillment of that plan. Some of the facets of that plan, for the Jewish people at least, are that the Jewish people should live in their land, which is the land of Israel. Be united, not in exile. Autonomous, under the rule of a king who is a descendant of the house of David. Now it's important to understand that in Torah, monarchy is the prescribed form of government, not democracy. You aware of that? Right? The Torah does not believe in democracy as a form of government. Because in the Torah system of government, there is no legislative function. Torah itself is complete. It is the guide and has the answers to all of mankind's problems. There's no need for a legislative function. There's only a need to be able to delve into the Torah and derive the answers, derive the information that we need to know. And therefore, there is no legislative function. Therefore, there's no need for representation. There's no need for a parliament. Whereas the Torah system of government is a monarchy wherein the king rules by the law of Torah. And the monarchy traditionally was vested in the house of David, King David, and his descendant, the Mashiach, the Messiah, the anointed king, will be the head of that new government. Yes?
But that was the only form of government known at the time, the monarchy. It's not as if there had been democratic experiments in the world and told us that this is not the way to live. We just weren't aware of it.
Okay, it's important to understand. It's a very good question. But it's important to understand that traditional Judaism, right, is based on the axiom that the Torah was given by God. It's divine. And that in turn, right, is based on the axiom that God is all-knowing, knows the future, and is all-wise, and is not confined to the historical standards of a given period in time. And therefore, when we examine Torah, it's not that Torah is relatively progressive. It's not that for its time it's progressive. Because by definition, what Torah is the Torah for all time. Now again, one of the ground rules for tonight is that we're not going to evaluate the claims of different religions or different denominations as to these facets. We're just laying down what historical Judaism has always believed. And this is one of its tenets, that the Torah is the Torah for all times. God, when he laid down a Torah which was appropriate for eternity. And therefore, it's understood that God's prescription of monarchy is not only because at the time the Torah was given, this was the only form of government known, but it was a prescription of monarchy because God believes this is the absolutely proper form of government. Not monarchy in the sense that we're accustomed to it. You see, we're used to the two poles of monarchy. Either an abusive monarchy or a figurehead monarchy. I'm not going to give any examples. But, I think we are officially subjects of a figurehead monarchy. What the idea of monarchy in the Torah is that the king, the monarch, is the conduit through which the people are connected to the national ideal. The national ideal is Torah and service of God. The king is the figure through which the nation is directed towards that end. So that's why the Mashiach is an essential part of the picture, but not the whole picture. You see, there's a lot of talk about Mashiach, 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 but it's important to keep things in perspective. That Mashiach is really only one element of that utopian plan. And many of the elements we'll see are not necessarily dependent on the personality of the Mashiach. Many of the aspects may occur before Mashiach appears in the scene. But that there should be a monarch from the house of David ruling the Jewish people is a part of that utopian plan. And therefore, it's an integral part, but not necessarily the total picture. It's not that everything is Messiah. So again, the elements are living in Israel, unity, autonomy, having a monarch, the restoration of the observance of the entire Torah. Now, there are 613 facets of Torah, 613 commandments. Many of them are only applicable in given sets of circumstances. For example, the Holy Temple must exist for the sacrificial rites to be performed. The Jewish population must be in place in Israel for many of the agricultural rules to be enforced. So one of the aspects of the Messianic Age is that the Torah will be restored to primacy, that the entire plan will be implemented. Now, it will also be an era of world peace, because we will be relieved from persecutions. And on top of all that, the Messianic Age doesn't only limit itself to the Jewish people, but it also involves all the nations of the world. To a greater extent or to a lesser extent, all peoples will be brought to true monotheism. Now, if I could just go off on a tangent for a moment. There is a section, the Rambam has a very interesting comment, which was censored out of virtualism of the Rambam. When the Rambam's works were published, when printing first was developed, and Hebrew books were published for the first time, printed for the first time, the hand of the Christian censor was very, very strong. And anything which was possibly considered as derogatory was eliminated. And there was a very illuminating paragraph in the Rambam that was censored out. It's in the next to the last chapter of the Rambam's magnum opus, which is called Mishneh Torah, wherein he is discussing the Mashiach. And he has a very fascinating statement, wherein he says as follows. He says that it was prophesied by Daniel that there would be those that would attempt to make messianic claims in advance of the advent of the true Messiah. And they will stumble. And the Rambam says that certainly this includes the messianic claim of Jesus, and perhaps as well the claims of Muhammad. Says the Rambam that why is it that God allowed for the success of Christianity and Islam? Now, we believe that God not only controls our individual lives, but he guides the course of history. Because why did God allow for the magnificent success of Christianity and Islam? It's a good question. And there are certainly, in terms of reaching thousands and millions of people, these two religions, which are essentially Jewish offshoots, were more successful than their parent religion. Why was that? So the Rambam says that the thoughts of the Creator, the thoughts of God, are deeper and more profound than the thoughts of man. Because there are things that God does which are beyond our grasp and are infinitely deeper than anything man can imagine. The Rambam says as follows, that Christianity and Islam have paved the road, paved the way for the fulfillment of the messianic ideal. Because when the Messiah is going to come and bring the world to true monotheism, how could he do so? If he was to confront a pagan world, how could he possibly bring the pagan to monotheism? You know, as outlandish as paganism seems to us monotheists, monotheism would seem equally outlandish to a pagan. Because imagine a pagan who is used to the idea of a god being something that one can touch, and one can feel, and one can have an intimate relationship with. How could you tell that pagan there is one god who is without physical form, beyond our grasp, invisible, transcendent? How is a pagan going to understand that? So therefore the Rambam says that Christianity and Islam are intermediate stages. Because Christianity is a stage which is between paganism and monotheism. It happens to be that in the Rambam's belief closer to paganism. Closer to paganism. Because it believes in some of the essential aspects of paganism. The idea of incarnation, the idea of mediation. So it has many pagan elements which may have been introduced precisely to bring in the pagans. Islam is closer to pure monotheism. But these are intermediate steps. So that, as a result of Christianity and Islam, the entire world is talking about the Messiah. The messianic ideal is known to Western man. So that ultimately, when the Mashiach comes, he'll have no problem bringing the population of the world to monotheism. He'll very easily point out the errors in Christian thought and in Islamic thought, and the entire world brought to monotheism. Now, it could be that Rabbi Skolback already has done that. So, in which case, that maybe we should crown him Mashiach, at least for this group. But, in any case, when Mashiach finally comes, says the Rambam, he will do that. And that's why Christianity and Islam actually play a role in the Messianic drama. But these are the things that the Mashiach will do, or that will happen in the Messianic age. It'll be an era of world peace, it'll be an era in which the utopian plan of Torah will be implemented, and the monarchy will be restored, and there is no necessity that miracles will take place. Miracles may take place. But it is not a fundamental of faith to believe that miracles will take place in the Messianic age. It could very well take place through very, very, unmiraculous processes. And it may be that some of these Messianic events will precede the coming of the Messiah. There is quite a bit of reason to believe that the ingathering of the exiles forever, for example, may take place before there is a personal Messiah. It may even be that the rebuilding of the temple, according to some sources, may take place before the arrival of the Messiah. And therefore, if a person is a little open-minded and willing to engage in speculation, one may imagine that, for example, the toppling of the Iron Curtain and the ingathering of the Russian exiles to Israel may very well be a messianic event. Not that the Messiah has come, but rather, this is a preliminary stage in the development of a messianic utopia. So you would not be far off, you would certainly not be guilty of a heresy if you believe that we are living in a sense, messianic times, at least in times that the groundwork for the messianic utopia is being laid. Yes?
Do you consider the Arab-Israeli peace accord along those lines?
Well, that's a very good question. I'll comment on it a little bit later, but if we get to it, and we'll talk about the wars of Gog and Magog, the apocalypse, the Armageddon in Jewish literature, there is a tradition In this Armageddon, there's a difference of opinion as to who the combatants are going to be. Traditionally, it's held that it'll be the Jewish people against all the nations of the world. However, there are other traditions in which it is believed that the Armageddon will be between various groups of nations of the world, perhaps between the Christian world and the Islamic world, and the Jews in Israel will be mere bystanders, you know, in this war. There is a tradition in one source from the sainted Vilna Gaon, writing in the late 1700s, wherein he says that the Armageddon will be between the Christian world and the Islamic world, but there will be a fifth column within the Jewish people, which will be manipulating to turn Jerusalem over to one side or the other. Now, he was writing this approximately 1790. Now, that seems almost prophetic, because if you follow the news, you know that Israel has established relations with the Vatican, and now the Pope wants his chunk of Jerusalem, and the Arafat wants his chunk of Jerusalem, and it seems that the government is actually, everything's on the table. There was contrary to the wishes of the public. Now, it's important to know that the approval, according to polls in Israel, approval for the peace process is only at 30%. 70% of the population is opposed to the peace process. And therefore, it would seem that the government's manipulations are maybe some messianic significance even to these events. Of course, one warning the rabbi does give us is don't point at events and give them definite interpretations. There's a great danger in pinpointing events and saying this is the significance of this event, this is the significance of this event, but it certainly, if the Messiah comes soon, we will look back at these events in hindsight and be able to put them in perspective, and if he doesn't come, then we'll just know that we were reading too much significance into them. This is just one of those things that we have no way of knowing. Now, at this point, it's important for us to reiterate something which I'm sure that you've discussed in the past weeks, which is that at this point, we really come to the essential parting of the ways of Christianity and Judaism, which is in terms of the definition of the role of the Messiah. In other words, from the conceptualization of the Rambam, which is based in the Talmud, which is based in turn on the books of prophecy, we have the Messiah as a political leader, who is a monarch, who reigns over the nation of Israel, who supervises the ingathering of the exiles and the reconstruction of the temple, if that had not yet been done. And by those definitions, the messianic claim of Christianity is obviously false. The messianic claim of Christianity, the claim that Jesus is the Messiah, is essentially based on a redefinition of the role of the Messiah. It's important to understand that. It is based on a redefinition of the role of the Messiah. That the Messiah is not imagined as being a liberator from persecution, oppression, in gather of the exiles, but rather the Messiah is conceived as a liberator of mankind from the burden of sin. And that is the parting of the ways. You see, I had a friend, I don't know whether he was a friend, but he was an acquaintance, who was a messianic rabbi. He was the rabbi of a messianic congregation, which was just around the corner from my house in San Diego, where I used to live. And
another Californian, right?
Really? Where are you from?
Palisades.
Oh, okay. Oh, California is a big place. We never met. But in any case, one Friday night, I decided I would go and visit with a friend, and we'll see if we can, get to know this fellow. So we went, and we caught the tail end of the service, and after we spoke to him, I asked him about his background, and he didn't have much of a Jewish background, so I asked him, are you interested in learning about Judaism? He says, yes, I'd be very interested. So for quite a while, we were learning. I began to suspect that I was actually giving him the material for his sermons, so I don't know if it was productive. But he used to, and it was Paul Lieberman, he used to say that, you know, there's no difference between the two of us. Because we really believe the same things. It's only that I believe that the Messiah already came, and you believe that the Messiah did not yet come. So that's a very minor area of difference. To which I explain that not at all. That is not the difference. That is not the difference in our beliefs. It's not that we believe in the same thing. It's just you believe he came, I believe he didn't come. The difference is that to claim that the Messiah has already come, you are redefining what the Messiah is. Because by the traditional Jewish definition of the Messiah, the claim that Jesus is the Messiah is preposterous. Now, once you understand that, then the entire Christian theology essentially falls into place. Because, number one, you have to believe that man needs liberation from sin, right? Which in turn necessitates the belief in original sin, etc. It necessitates the belief that man cannot be justified in God's eyes through good works, but only through faith and the acceptance of Jesus as the Messiah. Furthermore, in order to explain why the death of Jesus is unique in its ability to effect liberation from sin, as opposed to the death of the thousands of other righteous martyrs that have died in the course of history, you have to say that Jesus is unique in some way because he is not a mere mortal who died and somehow atoned for the rest of us, because in that sense he would be no different than any other person, but you have to somehow ascribe divinity to Jesus. You have to believe in the concept of incarnation, etc. Everything falls into place once you accept this fundamental redefinition of the role of the Messiah. So keep in mind that Judaism does not believe in that. Judaism does not believe that the role of the Messiah is to liberate man from sin. Man stands on his own two feet. Man is brought into this world. He can be justified in the eyes of God. He can live a good life, an upright life, a life of which God would be proud. He can merit the world to come, the bliss of the world to come. He does not need to ascribe to the sacrifice of the Son of God or any such belief in order to achieve salvation. The role of the Messiah is to relieve us from political oppression and to usher in an era of world peace. Now, the belief in the Messiah, getting back to Jewish belief, has been one of those beliefs which has sustained the Jewish people for the thousands of years of persecutions in its history. The truth is that the survival of the Jewish people is nothing short of miraculous. But what has sustained them, almost more than anything else, has been the belief in the Messiah. You see, every other ancient nation that did not ascribe to the Messianic ideal believes that its history began in some distant golden age from which we have been drifting farther and farther away as time has passed. In that sense, if our golden age is past and our present is oppressive, what hope is there for the future? Judaism always looked forward as well as backward. It looked backward to our glorious experience of revelation on Mount Sinai, wherein we received the word of God, but it looked forward to the ultimate embodiment of that revelation, which would be the Messianic age, and that gave hope for Jewish people to survive the worst persecutions. Because even during the Holocaust, Jews marched to the concentration camps singing the words of Ani Maamin, I believe with a complete faith that the world will see better days. And that is the Messianic age. Now, the Rambam tells us an amazing thing. The Rambam tells us, and now we're going to just discuss some facets of the Messianic age, that one of the beliefs that is a fundamental belief is not merely that there will be a Messianic age, but that the Messianic age can begin, be ushered in, at any moment. And this is what we say in the Ani Maamin, in our creed, that even though the Messiah tarries, we wait for him every day that he should come. In other words, the fundamental belief is not merely that there will be a Messianic age in some distant point in the future. But that, if the Jewish people are deserving, it can come at any given time. Now, the basis for this is an apparent contradiction that we find in the Talmud and in the prophecies. On the one hand, we have prophecies and statements in the Talmud that refer to what is called the Kates. Kates, it's a Hebrew word. Kates means the end. The end. That there is an end. There is a deadline. There is a time by which everything has to fall into place. The Kates. The Talmud tells us that Jacob, our patriarch, on his deathbed, wanted to reveal the Kates. God didn't allow him. Daniel had prophecies of the Kates, when the Kates would be. The Talmud has discussions of when the Kates will be. It's very interesting. You know, in those prophecies of Daniel, there have been many interpretations. Because there are different figures that are given. One verse says it'll be 2,300 years. Another verse says it'll be 1,335 years. Another verse says it'll be 1,290 years. So how do we reconcile these dates? When do you start counting from? So in each generation, each sage gave an interpretation which placed the Messianic age just a short time ahead. For example, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, who was the leader of the Jews in Babylonia, in his classic book, he writes that the Messiah, the deadline for the Messiah is the year 968. 968. Now, Rabbi Sadia Gaon died in the year 921. So, we don't know exactly when he was writing, but sometime before 921, it's coming! 968! Needless to say, that over 1,000 years have passed since then, Messiah didn't come. Rashi, the classical commentator, is convinced that the Messiah will come in, now I have to remember my dates, 1352. That was his deadline. 1352. Of course, the Rashi died in 1105. Nachmanides, who lived into the 1200s, believed it would be 1358. He's convinced of it. He writes it in several places. Didn't happen. And commentators have been writing and writing and writing and writing ever since. Now, the most recent universally accepted commentary to the Bible was written by a scholar called the Malbim, lived in Czechoslovakia. He was writing this part of his commentary. He tells you the exact month. In the Hebrew month Cheshvan, which is usually about October, November, of the year 1867. He writes exactly, I am writing these words this month. And he predicted that the Messiah is going to come in a process that will begin in 1913 and end in 1928. And to put icing on the cake, he says that in mystical tradition, it says that in the last several hundred years before the Messiah's coming, every 60 years is an auspicious time that the Messiah could come early. And therefore, he says, since I predicted he's going to come in 1928 at latest, so 40 years before that is 1868. Remember, he's writing in 1867. And he says, and it could be that it'll be next year. Needless to say, it didn't happen. So there's always been effort to interpret these prophecies in ways, and sadly, they've all turned out to be false. I mean, I've dabbled in it myself a little bit. You know, sometimes you try to figure out, oh, what do I think it means? I'm not going to tell you what I came out to, but close. It's coming close. Strangely enough, the Talmud says that people who try to calculate when the end will be should be blown away. That's what it says. Tipach rucham. Their soul should be blown away. The people that try to calculate the ends. Because there are two terrible consequences of these calculations. Number one, which is that they lead to terrible, terrible demoralization when they don't come true. And Jewish history has been marked by many episodes of false messiahs who have brought nothing but tragedy in their wake, in that they totally demoralized and disillusioned the populations of their followers. Shabtai Tzvi, of course, is the most famous of the false messiahs. Shabtai Tzvi functioned between 1648 and 1670 or so. And he's the most famous, of course, 100 years later, Jacob Frank and many others. That is one consequence of the false messiahs. The other of calculating the ends, of course, the other negative consequence is that the end is really only the deadline, the time by which he must come. But the truth is, there's a totally separate tradition. There's, on the one hand, the Kates, but on the other hand, there's the concept the Mashiach could come any moment. And that we see from other texts of the Talmud, a fantastic story in the Talmud. The Talmud says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, he was a great sage, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, was once visiting the grave of the great sage Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, famous sage, Lag BaOmer, at his grave in Meiron, northern Israel. There were massive celebrations. So he was there. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai engaged him in conversation. He was speaking to the deceased Shimon bar Yochai. And he asked him, am I going to go into the world to come? So he said, if God wants. That's what he said. Anyway, so he didn't get too far in that part of the conversation. So he asked him another question. Tell me, he says, when is Mashiach going to come? So Shem Yochai says, well, why don't you go ask him? So he says, where is he? So he says, you have to go to the gate of the city. He's sitting among the lepers. That's where the Messiah sits, among the lepers. And how can I tell which one is Messiah? So he says like this. He says, all the other lepers, when they are bandaging and rebandaging their wounds, they unwrap one wound, and then they unwrap the other. They unwrap all their wounds, and they clean all their wounds, and then they rebandage them. But the Messiah doesn't do it that way. He unwraps one wound, and he cleans it, and then rebandages it, and then goes to the next. Why? Because he might be called on a moment's notice to come. And therefore he'd be delayed if he would have unbandaged all his wounds, right? It'll take him that extra few moments to get himself together, and that will delay the redemption. So therefore the Messiah bandages himself differently, and therefore that's how you know he's coming. So, okay. Now, obviously these statements have to be taken metaphorically, but there's a lesson here. In other words, that the redemption can come any moment. So he says, he went to the Messiah, and he found him, and he asked him, when are you coming? And he says, today. Today. Let me mention something else. Before he asked when he's coming, he didn't just ask, he says, Shalom Aleichem. How do you do? And the Messiah answered to him, Shalom Alecha Bar Levi. Welcome unto you, son of Levi. Yeshua ben Levi, Yeshua son of Levi. Then he asked, when are you coming? And he said, today. So he went back to the grave of Shimon Yochai, and Shimon Yochai asked him, so, well, what happened? So he says, well, I said hello to him, and he answered back. He says, hello, son of Levi. So he said, oh, you're for sure going to the world to come. If Mashiach spoke to you, you must be somebody special. You're going to go to the world to come. Now, what did he say when he's coming? So he said, well, he said, he lied to me. He lied to me. He says, I asked him when he's coming. He said, he's coming today. He didn't come. He says, no, you misunderstood him. When he said today, what he meant was, today, if you listen to God's word. Hayom im bekolo tishma'u. Today, if you listen to God's word. That's what he meant. It was understood. So there are two traditions. There's the concept of kates, the end, the deadline, and there's the concept of Mashiach being able to come at any time. The Talmud resolves the contradiction. The Talmud says that if the Jews are deserving, it can come at any time. If the Jews are not deserving, then it will come at a prescribed time, which is inevitable. There must be the Messianic age. If the Jews aren't deserving, it'll happen even so. But it will happen. So there are these two concepts. The concept of end, kates, by which time it must happen, and the concept of that it could be sped up, if we're deserving, and therefore part of our belief is the hope that it may possibly come at any time. Yes?
That's the Gemara's line of not pinpointing when the end of time is supposed to be fit in with those.
Therefore, the Talmud is saying like this. The Talmud says that, see, if we believed that Messiah could only come at a given time, then perhaps we should speculate. But whereas we believe that the Messiah can come at any time, can come at any moment, so therefore the speculation as to when Messiah must come is really counterproductive. Number one, right, if we're mistaken, it's discouraging. And number two, if we, let's say, determine that the date of his coming is far off, it'll also be discouraging. But it doesn't have to be that way, because we understand that the fact that the case is far off doesn't mean the Messiah can't come earlier. And that's why, as a rule, there is no benefit to making these calculations.
Right. So the nature of my question was that, unless I misunderstood you, you said earlier that if Gemara said that anybody who predicts it,
Should be blown away.
That was my question.
That question is a good question. The question is, if the Talmud says you shouldn't make such calculations,
what
are the great sages of Israel doing making such calculations? So this is a problem that has been discussed by many. The Ramban, in one of his books, gives a very classic answer. He says like this. He says that he argues that the real reason why we shouldn't make these calculations is not because we're scared of error. Not because we're scared of error and that it'll pass and there'll be disillusionment. Because the truth is, sages of Israel always have to be self-confident. You know, a Jewish scholar is called to give decisions on life and death matters. Whereas Jewish law isn't only relevant to saying the right prayers and that type of thing. Whereas Jewish law is relevant to life and death situations. When a patient, God forbid, is hooked up to a respirator, and the question is, a DNR order, that type of thing. Now, these are areas that fall under the scope of Jewish law, of halacha. And a Jewish rabbi, whether he's qualified to answer these questions, you can't just, you have to be someone who's trained to answer these questions, but they are called upon to make life and death decisions. And you have to be fearless. You can't concern yourself with the possibility of making an error. If you use your judgment properly, you have to have confidence in your verdict. And therefore, the Ramban argues, the real reason is not because we're scared you'll make a mistake, and you'll predict it too early, and as a result, there'll be disillusionment. The real reason is because, to the contrary, you might predict it as being too late, and as a result, there'll be disillusionment, because people will despair that the Messiah won't come for many hundreds of years. And therefore, to maintain the hope that he can come constantly, we don't predict the case. Says the Ramban, therefore, this was only applicable in the times of the Talmud. In the times of the Talmud, let's say the Ramban, for example, he himself said that the prediction of the Messiah, of his coming, would be in the year 1358. Now, the Talmud was written 1,000 years before that. So at the time of the Talmud, you know why the sages said don't make the calculations? Because the sages of the Talmud knew the answer. They knew what the real calculation was. They knew that the answer was 1358. This is Ramban's reasoning, right? And therefore, if someone in Talmudic times would have made that calculation, he would come and say, the Messiah is coming in 1,000 years. It would be despair. 1,000 years we have to wait. We're not going to make it 1,000 years. And therefore, that's why the calculations weren't made. But, says the Ramban, in our times, since it's so close, we can make these calculations. Because to the contrary, it won't lead to despair, it'll lead to encouragement, because people will believe that the redemption is imminent. Now, of course, right, his calculation was mistaken. But that was the justification, because in each generation, they came to an interpretation of the verses, and they genuinely believed that the redemption was imminent. There's a famous parable that is given to this, and I think this brings it down to earth. There was a famous preacher called the Maggid of Dubna. He was a preacher, and he used to give parables for everything. Every time he would be asked to speak, it would be a parable. Just to give you an illustration of his skill at giving parables, once someone asked him, why is it that whenever you give a sermon, you always have a parable? So he says, I'll give you a parable. He says, there was once an archer who wanted to demonstrate how good he was at shooting bows, shooting arrows. So what he did was, he shot the arrows into the tree, and then he painted the bullseye around it. So it's the same thing. It's not that, in other words, whenever I have a point I'd like to bring up, I think of a parable. If I have a good story, I tell the story, and that's the moral for that week. Anyway, so he always had a parable. So he gave a parable for this. He said there once was a man who was traveling to a wedding, and he took his young son with him. And it was a long trip, you know, hundreds of kilometers over, you know, roads and by horse and buggy in those days. So as soon as they leave the house, the son asks his father, says, "How long is it going to be until we get there?" So the father said, "Ah, shut up, be quiet." And they go, they travel. Anyway, after a while, the father stops the wagon and asks someone, "How far is it until such and such?" And the guy tells him it's whatever, another 10 kilometers. So the kid asks his father, "I don't understand." He says, "When I asked you how long it was, you told me to shut up." He says, "And now you're asking the same question." So he says, "There's a big difference." He says, when you had asked, we had just left the house. So at that point, what would I tell you? It's another 1,000 kilometers. Another 2 weeks till we get there. I mean, you'd be terribly despondent. He says, but in my instance, we were just there. So as the time approaches, we have to prepare ourselves. We have to find ourselves a place to stay. We have to get our clothes prepared. We have to, you know, resettle things in the wagon. So as the time approaches, that's when we have to know. So the Dudna Maga said it's the same thing. That in Talmudic times, because the sages foresaw that it would be so long, therefore they said don't make these calculations. But in our times, because it is so imminent, we are allowed to make these calculations. The problem is that, sadly, all the calculations have not turned up. And interestingly enough, that all modern commentators, with all commentaries that have been written, I think, since the Malbim, have all avoided precise interpretation of those verses. It was precisely for that reason, because there are so many calculations that have been wrong. Now, why do I mention it? This isn't only an arcane issue of calculating dates, but there's a different concept included in this, which is that part of our faith in the coming of the Mashiach is not to place restrictions on the way that God is going to bring it about. Not to limit it to a specific time, not to limit it to a specific person, not to limit it to a specific set of circumstances. You see, because the prophecies and the statements in the Talmud, the Rambam tells us, are not readily understandable. We don't necessarily know what they mean. We may be misinterpreting them. And therefore, it's important that in our faith remain, in a sense, simple. Because we believe there'll be a Messiah, we believe there'll be a Messianic age, but not to put restrictions on it and say that it must be this way, it must happen this way, it can't be otherwise. When we do that, we are opening ourselves open to disappointment, and in fact, we are undermining faith. Okay, this is one concept, the concept of the end. There's another concept I'd like to mention in our discussion about Mashiach, which is the concept of what is called Chevlei Mashiach. Chevlei Mashiach are the birth pangs of the Messiah. The concept of birth pangs is that it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Now, this is a concept which has crept into Christian thought, that there is going to be a time of tribulation. And this is something which has been borrowed. It's a Jewish idea. Why is it so? Oh, thank you so much. How did you know? Well, that's some potent water. Anyway, tribulations. Why is it called birth pangs? So the reason is it's a metaphor. Just like when a baby is born. So the mother goes through 9 months of relative discomfort. But then, at the last moment, there's an intense pain, labor. So likewise, the coming of the Messianic age is also metaphorically described as a birth process. And therefore, in the same way that there's a stage of labor, there'll be a stage of tribulation, of pain, that will precede the coming of the Messiah. Another metaphor for the Messianic age is that it is called dawn. And there's a saying, I don't know how accurate it is, that it's always blackest before the dawn. So likewise, the period before the coming of the Messiah is especially bleak. To the extent that the Talmud records a dispute, very interesting dispute, there were two sages, Rav Yochanan and Rabbah, who said that let the Messiah come, but let me not see it. Let me not see it. In other words, the tribulations that were foretold before the coming of the Messiah were so terrible that they said, I don't want to see it. Rav Yosef said, he said like this, he says, let Messiah come, even if it is only so that I should merit to sit in the shadow of the manure of his donkey. That's what Talmud says. Even if all I'll have of the messianic bliss is to sit in the shadow of the manure of the donkey of the Messiah, I want to be there. Now what does that mean? As an aside, to sit in the shadow of the manure of the donkey of the Messiah.
By that time the bird pangs are over. He can be there without any...
Okay, but what does it mean? What is the bliss of sitting in the shadow of the manure of the donkey? So there's an interpretation given by one of the classic expositors of the Agoda, the non-legal portions of the Talmud, the Maharal, who was the chief rabbi of Prague in the 1600s, says as follows. He says that the Messianic age is going to be a spiritual time. Because we've been talking about some of the political ramifications, but it'll also be a spiritual time. It will be a time wherein Torah ideals will be commonly held, where people will aspire to spirituality, to holiness. It's a spiritual time. The opposite of spirituality is a donkey. Why is that? You see, the conflict between the spirit and the body, really in Hebrew, is the conflict between the mind, the seichel, and the chomer. Chomer is the Hebrew word for matter, substance, the physical side of man. That is the source of tension between spirituality and its opposite. The Hebrew word for donkey is chamor, related to chomer, substance, matter. Now, it's not a coincidence. Right? The reason it is that way is because we recognize that in everything that lives, there are spiritual elements and there are physical elements. Now, in the human being, the spiritual potentiality far outweighs the pure physical side. In other animals, their potential for spirituality obviously is limited. But the least spiritual animal is a donkey. A donkey was considered such a dumb beast of burden that its potential for spirituality was by definition limited. And therefore the donkey is the exemplar of something which is non-spiritual. Now, what is the most unspiritual part of the donkey? Right? The manure of the donkey. Because why is the manure the most unspiritual part of the donkey? Maybe I'm belaboring the obvious, but why is it? So according to mystical tradition, when we eat food, you eat a luscious apple, and a few hours later, the body eliminates the waste. That waste looks nothing, smells nothing, like the original apple. Now why is that? Now, I know you're going to tell me, well, it goes to the stomach and the digestive juices and the acids and break it down, etc., etc., etc. But in a spiritual sense, there's another process going on, say the mystics. You see, because everything that we eat, everything that exists, contains within it sparks of holiness. Called nitzotzos of kedusha, sparks of holiness. When you take that food into yourself, your body removes those sparks of holiness, integrates those elements of holiness into your soul. And what is rejected, what is pushed out, is the food devoid of holiness. So you can take the most beautiful apple. Once you remove the elements of holiness, that's what you're left with. And therefore, the most non-spiritual part of the donkey, which is already the most non-spiritual animal, is the manure of the donkey. So says Rabbi Yosef, that the spiritual level of the Messianic age will be so high that the most mundane, non-spiritual act, such as sitting in the shadow of the manure of a donkey, will be so lofty and spiritual that it will transcend any experience that we can have in our contemporary world. And therefore, Rabbi Yosef said it's worth all the tribulations. It's worth going through all the tribulations to have that experience of the Messianic age. Now, of these Chevelei Mashiach, of these tribulations, of these birth pangs, there are essentially two sorts. The Talmud, on the one hand, describes a tremendous moral breakdown. That there'll be a tremendous breakdown of the moral fabric of society in the era immediately preceding the Messianic Age, especially within the Jewish community. There will be a decline of scholarship. There will be people that are totally estranged from their heritage. Truth will be missing. Truth will depart. The Talmud says that truth will be like a flock of sheep. And the metaphor is so appropriate. Because in a flock of sheep, every sheep walks its own way. It's not just that the truth will be forgotten and false values will be accepted, but the very concept of truth will disappear. Because we live in a time, I don't know if you realize it, that there is no concept of truth anymore. The idea of absolute values has ceased to exist in 20th century society. The truth has become relative. The only virtue is openness and the willingness to accept all values. And that was foretold by the Talmud, that would be a sign of the Messianic times. There'll be no leadership in Messianic times. It says that Pnei Hador, the face of the generation, will be the face of the leaders of the generation, will be like the faces of dogs. So there's been a traditional interpretation, a classic interpretation given by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, one of the good ethical teachers of Judaism, who gave the following interpretation. When you take a dog out for a walk, so the dog walks ahead. So a casual observer might think that the dog is leading the master. But is that so? No, because the dog is very subtly looking behind to take cues from its master. So likewise, he says, there'll be no real leadership in the pre-Messianic times. Because leaders will be taking their cues from their followers, from their constituents. I mean, if that is not prophetic, I don't know what is. Because we live in a time that there is no leadership anymore. Those politicians take polls. And without shame. Or they consider it a matter of virtue that they're going to open their phone lines and have call-in polls, they can poll their constituents, to decide how to vote on the various matters which the government has declared to be open votes, because it isn't willing to take a stand and risk, the government falling. So there isn't any leadership. In other words, everything is really a question of polling. Right? Just by the way, you should know that there always were two schools of thought about representative government, whether representatives should, in fact, merely express the popular sentiment, or whether they should use their own judgment. But I think we've descended to a new depth of irresponsibility in leadership. The Talmud says that places that were formerly centers of scholarship, Beis Havad, Yiel Iznus, will become places of promiscuity. Now, I think, thank God, it hasn't yet come to Jewish academies. But certainly the college campus, which was once upon a time a center of scholarship, has really become a center or centers of promiscuity. So there are a lot of predictions. You go through the Talmud, one after the other, exactly hitting the target for times that we live, pointing to a general moral breakdown. Even the economic breakdown is predicted. The inflation, the unemployment. The Talmud says explicitly two of the signs of the Messianic Age is that people will not have money in their pockets. And number two, people will not be able to find jobs. People will not be able to hire themselves out. The Talmud says, now the Talmud was written, keep in mind, 1,500 years ago, over 1,500 years ago, almost 1,600 years ago, and said this will happen in the pre-Messianic age. And one by one, the predictions seem to be coming true. The other set of predictions of the Chevlei Moshiach, of the birth pangs of the Messiah, are related to the terrible political conflicts that will take place. And these are lumped under the heading of Mochemes Gog Umagog, the wars of Gog and Magog. Now,
so the Armageddon?
Well, Armageddon is
an
Anglicized form of actually these words, Gog and Magog. Now, let's understand a little bit about these words. Gog is the name of the king. Magog is the name of his kingdom. Now, just to give you a little bit of background in terms of biblical heritage. After the flood, when Noah was saved, Noah had three sons. Okay, the three sons of Noah were Shem, Chum, and Yafes. Okay? Now, the Bible tells us exactly how the various nations are descendants. The Jewish people are descendants of Shem. So the Jews. And our cousins. Our cousins. Who are our two sets of cousins? The Arabs are our cousins, right? Because if you follow the course, Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Yishmael. Yishmael is the father of the Arabs. Jacob had two sons. Excuse me. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau is the father of what is called Edom and Amalek, which are also traditional arch enemies of the Jewish people. Okay, so Jews and their cousins come from Shem. From Yafes come many of the countries that ultimately are the European countries. The Greeks come from Yafes. The Persians come from Yafes. Right? The Romans may be related to the Greeks. Chum are Hamitic peoples, the ancient Egyptians, not the modern Egyptians. They came from Chum. Now, we always tell ourselves, we always imagine that the wars of the Gog and Magog, the final conflict, will somehow be related to the traditional arch-enemies of the Jewish people, which are Yishmael and Esav. But strangely enough, Magog happens to be one of the descendants of Yafes in the Bible. Very strange. And the various prophecies that discuss the wars of Gog and Magog depict an alliance of many nations which are not traditional antagonists of the Jewish people. Right? Not the traditional enemies that we're accustomed to thinking of. So there's a lot of confusion in the commentators how to understand these alliances. We can't go into the details, we can't go into the texts. But there are various schools of thought. One school of thought is that, true, Magog is a descendant of Yafes. But Gog himself is not of native stock of Magog. Gog himself may be a descendant of one of the traditional arch enemies of the Jewish people. Perhaps he is a descendant of Yishmael, or perhaps he is a descendant of Esav. Okay? So let's understand that. We're just going to make a chart to remember who's who. Okay? You have Abraham. He has two sons, Isaac and Yishmael. Right, these are the Arabs. Isaac has two sons,
Jacob and Esau. Okay? So now, these are the traditional arch enemies of the Jewish people. Esau and Ishmael. So we have sources that seem to indicate that Gog, who is the king of this nation, Magog, which is totally unrelated, may be somehow related to one of these two people. He may be a descendant of Ishmael. He may be a descendant of Esau. In some traditions, there is a new leader who's introduced. There's Gog. There are some midrashic sources that indicate that Gog comes from Ishmael, but there is another leader who comes from Esau called Armilus. Armilus. Armilus is reminiscent of the name Romulus. Romulus was the mythological founder of the city of Rome. Rome, of course, is traditionally identified with Esau in Jewish sources. So the picture, without going into details, the picture seems to develop as follows. That in the Mohemes Gog and Magog, in the wars of Gog and Magog, we have an alliance of nations which are not traditional antagonists of the Jewish people, being led by traditional enemies of the Jewish people in this massive war. Or that's really what I want to get at. The names aren't significant. But the point is that there seems to be a concept in Jewish tradition that this war will involve an alliance of not traditional enemies of the Jewish people, led by traditional enemies of the Jewish people. Now, certainly, many of the alliances which we see today of nations, European nations. Someone was just telling me today that they saw a speech on C-SPAN when they were in the States. They saw Arafat speaking to the European Parliament. And, you know, they were asking these questions, which clearly gave the impression that they believed that the Palestinians were the most oppressed people. They said, you know, it's obvious that we all know that all these terrible things are happening to your people, and the questioner would elaborate on them. He says, but, and they would ask some little detailed question at the end of their address. So, you know, we certainly see that nations that may not have been traditional enemies of the Jewish people, led or motivated or inspired by traditional enemies of the Jewish people, and this may be connected to the concept of the war of Gog and Magog. As I mentioned before, there is even a debate as to who the combatants will be in this war. Right, whether it will be these alliances against the Jews, or it may be these alliances against one another over Jerusalem, over the land of Israel, and Jews may be innocent bystanders in these wars. Right, not clear at all. But there are three prophecies, right? Two in the book of Ezekiel, and one in the book of Zechariah, where these wars are described, and according to the Talmud's interpretation of these texts, there will be three invasions of Israel. In one, the invading forces will be repelled far from Jerusalem. In the second, they will be repelled at the gates of Jerusalem. And in the third, they will actually be successful in taking away half the city. That's what it says in the prophets. They will actually take half the city. And then they will be defeated. Now, that half the city is certainly reminiscent of the partition of the city of Jerusalem. Again, we don't know what any of the prophecies mean. But every so often, a detail seems to jump out at us, and we take note of it. there is a belief or an idea which many have expressed, which is that whereas we don't know precisely how to interpret the prophecies and how to interpret the Talmudic statements or what credence we should give them, that perhaps we already have experienced the tribulations of the Messianic age. And it certainly is possible. Any person who has studied the Holocaust would certainly understand that the Holocaust meets and exceeds all the criteria of the Messianic tribulations. I mean, the death and the brutality and the suffering was... There is no prophecy that even begins to bring out the horror of the Holocaust. So despite the fact that we have not had the coming of the Messiah per se, we haven't had the full-blown experience of the Messianic age, it could very well be that we have already fulfilled, in a sense, we've already endured enough. We've fulfilled our obligation of tribulation, and now the Messianic age can happen. If I would engage in some speculation, I would say that, in a sense, the process of the Messianic age may have begun. In other words, as a consequence of the Holocaust, the State of Israel was established, and as a consequence of that, we have a much larger Jewish presence than ever was. We have had, and we have witnessed, the ingathering of exiles, of Jewish refugees from the Arab nations, now from the Soviet Union, increased immigration from America. It could very well be these are all messianic processes. There is a tradition that the Vilna Gaon and other Jewish authors have expressed that the first stages of the Messianic age will be very natural and very gradual. And therefore it could be that we are witnessing some of these events. The Talmud tells us that one of the signs of the Messianic age will be the increased fruitfulness of the land of Israel. And certainly the fact that that Israel has been successful in turning the desert into a flourishing agricultural area is certainly reminiscent of that prediction. So it could very well be that many of the tribulations we have predicted, certainly the predictions of moral breakdown, we have certainly experienced and are experiencing, and even the political, military predictions may have been fulfilled either in past events or in events that are unfolding at the present time. So the truth is that we should not despair of the coming of the Messiah, because we don't see the miraculous events occurring. The events may be occurring before our very eyes without our even noticing it. Right? So these are just some of the ideas about the traditional beliefs about the coming of the Messiah. We talked before about the resurrection and the world to come and where the coming of the Messiah fits in. And essentially, these three concepts of the tate, the end, the dialectic of either there being an end or Messiah's coming at any time, the tribulations of the coming of the Messiah, and the Gog and Magog, and of course the spiritual quality of the coming of the Messiah, which is an enhanced opportunity to serve God and to know God, and that all the nations of the world should join in that faith.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million-dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.